Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, today is April 2nd, 2015. This is an interview with Linda Newman. My name is Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW Mass and Oral History Program, and we're interviewing Linda about her time here on campus, specifically as a member of the academic staff. So Linda, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Sure. This is Linda Newman, and my last name is spelled N-E-W-M-A-N.
All right. That looks just right. I want to make sure we're pointed at the right number. All right, we are. So as I was chatting with you before we turned this on, I have a list of questions that I created when I thought we were going to do this interview at the Institute, and those are the questions that I'm going to follow here today. So the first is if you want to describe the reasons for and the process behind the first job you got at UW-Madison, which looks like it was in the late 70s for the History Department.
Right. And I came to Wisconsin in 1962 to earn my PhD in history and discover that I'm not a scholar, but I have an enormous affection for the History Department. In 78, I believe it was, I was working on campus as an LTE in the Marine Studies Center, and the woman with whom I shared the office said that the woman who worked as the, the departmental advisor is what comes to my mind, I'm not sure that's the term in history, was moving up to become secretary of the faculty. And perhaps I would like to apply to be the academic advisor, the departmental advisor for history, which I very much wanted to do. And at that time, Peter Smith was chair of the history department. I had been a student of David Lovejoy's and also had worked in the department as a research assistant and a teaching assistant. And Peter Smith hired me. Possibly that was 77, because I started right after the first of the new year, and I think you had recorded that was 78. So I worked for the History Department and enjoyed it thoroughly. It was a wonderfully different perspective from what I'd had as a graduate student, and when I had come to campus in 62 as a graduate student, the History Department was in Bascom. So it's been, there's so many ways it's a joy driving up here today, thinking, my goodness, I lived long enough to retire and be emeritus. And I love this place. So I worked advising undergraduates in the history department, which was a position that gave me lots and lots of access to faculty. We were then developing a writing requirement for undergraduates and integrated that in the history department into the seminar requirements, which I think pre-existed my term. I took over for Sue Finman when I became undergrad advisor. And we developed the major and the requirements, not that there wasn't one there already, but with an emphasis on writing and also an emphasis on some exposure to historiography. And I think both of those could be accomplished in taking the seminar, and everybody was required to take a seminar. And in addition to helping to put together the timetable, I got to work at SOAR, which I loved, and which became part of my time, the whole time that I was on campus before the first time I retired in 07. And I also wrote and published, as it were, the History Department newsletter. So having come in as a graduate student, I had a kind of understanding of the U.S., we called them caucuses then, the U.S. caucus, doing advising with undergraduates. Then I got to know the European caucus and the Third World caucus and made some very, very good, some lifelong friends with faculty in the history department. Don't remember. Yeah, I have, I was going to say. And I've hung on to some of my students, too. Just stayed in touch with them over time and what it is that they're doing. And was very much engaged with the quality of teaching that was available to the students. Very, very, very predictably differential across the faculty and the graduate students. And in those days, when I started, students enrolled with assignment committees. And those were a wonderful institution. It was a lot of legwork for the undergraduates to get their course schedules. But when you came into the history department downstairs in humanities, you had an array of graduate students enrolling you in classes, as well as me as the undergrad advisor. So we had lots to offer for what would go on with the class, what kinds of things were required. Sometimes it was the grad student who would be teaching that particular course. So it was a wonderfully interactive process mm-hmm. that we lost when we went into more automated ways of enrolling for classes. Mm-hmm. So
Linda, was that then the part of the official registration process for students? Mm-hmm. So if they were interested in a history class, they had to come find you all?
In the history department. Mm-hmm. And you would find the English department, the French department, and I don't know if they were two, but the stories were that you might also find your future spouse while you were waiting to see if you would get into French Revolution this semester or not. And then there were a fair number of tears of disappointment when you didn't get what you'd hoped you would get, and why in the world had you stood in line? The classrooms, as you probably know in humanities, often go down steeply, so we would be sitting at the bottom, and then they'd come down and hope that there'd still be a space in the class. Mm-hmm. Or could consult, if it was not so busy, with the graduate student sitting there, because, of course, graduate students have nothing so much as opinions. And sometimes the student would recognize they'd taken 101 history, they'd recognize their TA and then ask for advice. As I remember it, it was lovely. Mm-hmm. Those students might tell you, well, when it was raining, it wasn't so lovely. And when it was too hot, and then it was unpredictable. Mm-hmm. And that could be stressful, too. Mm-hmm. So.
And so in the late 70s, you did allude to this. In the late 70s, this was not an automated process.
No, not yet.
So was it all, when they would come down, was it all pen and paper? And somebody had to know what the class enrollment
right, and we
was.
Would have had that data available to us. And fairly early on, they were doing things with computer punch cards. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where the two intersected or exactly how that worked. We certainly had paper and pencil rosters that we were working from.
And you said you, at that point, so it looks like you worked at History for probably roughly 8 years.
Yes.
During that time, you were publishing the newsletter?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
How, again, in the sort of pre-digital age, how are you publishing a newsletter and how are you getting it to the people you want to get it to?
The department office mailed it out, and I actually hired a graphic artist who was working, I'm trying to think what department she was attached to. She was a friend of mine. She wasn't in the history department, but she designed a template for the front page. And my memory would be that I had a secretary, that's right. My secretary would probably type up the articles and then somebody formatted it because it was, how a newsletter would look in those days. Columns with I think all that Jana designed was History Department newsletter that just was the banner across the top. Mm-hmm. And the process by which my secretary or the staff downstairs, the office was third floor, my office was on the department office was third floor, my office was on the fourth floor, how they all got it out to alums. I suspect they had a mailing list and labels, but I don't know. And I feel as if I initiated it, and I think whoever the advisor was who came after me kept it up for a while, but it did not persist. And then as a quasi-alum, I finished a master's degree but didn't finish my PhD, I would get for a while the departmental newsletter. So it evolved into something that was much more under the auspices of the chair than it had been when I had started it.
And how would you get at or compile the content that would go into the newsletter?
Well, that's a good question. I must have circulated something to the faculty to know what was new. I did a few book reviews myself. I remember I wrote a review of one of Ancina's books. But I suspect the faculty would have provided me with information And I might have written about changes in the undergraduate major. I don't know that we were particularly interested in numbers then. I mean, we did major decks and all of that because that gave you a different kind of access. And it gave me some kind of handle on the number of majors we had. And I talked a lot with faculty as to what was happening in terms of undergraduate courses and working on the timetable, because I was responsible for the department's timetable, graduate and undergraduate, and helped to monitor enrollments, now that I think of it, because then, as I assume now, there was a minimum number. You needed to have X number in order for the course to go. And we would have trouble sometimes with grad seminars because you might have dissertators, but they might not be enrolling. And then there were a certain number of grad seminars the faculty wanted to offer that were not necessarily focused on their own graduate students who were doing the PhD with them. They were more broadly conceived as of interest to a whole range of graduate students, maybe not even in the history department. And then there were levels also for 100, 200, 300 level undergrad courses, and you didn't want those to be under-enrolled either. And I must have worked closely, I know I worked closely with the chair in the creation of the timetable, and I think also I was collaborating with the chair in terms of monitoring enrollments. And sometimes with the grad students, you'd be kind of, you know, getting in touch with your grad student who was doing her research on the ground in Africa and say, no, you need to enroll this semester because we need the count, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
The other thing you mentioned that I'd like to get to before we move to your change in position, your change on your job change on campus, is you mentioned that you got to work at SOAR.
Right.
So
right.
First off, just because we don't know who will listen to this and what context they'll listen to,
right.
I wonder if you could explain briefly what SOAR is and then maybe what your involvement in it was.
Right. SOAR, initially, it's an acronym, and it was Student Orientation and Advising for Registration. And the College of Letters and Science, students and their parents were invited to campus at that point, I think probably just maybe for a day and a half. And at that point, it was very much the College of Letters and Science's project. And as an advisor in history, I was invited to participate 1 year. I was hired 9 months, but then if I were working at SOAR, orienting the students who would be freshmen in the fall or be entering the university as a transfer student, so with credits coming so that he or she might enter as a sophomore, junior, or senior, bringing credits from other post-secondary institutions. And it was a very, very collegial process. So you got out from, you know, looking at the world through the department into understanding the college as a whole. At that point, for me, the colleges and the schools and colleges all over campus were a very dim concept. And I would work at SOAR that one summer as an advisor, and I had current undergraduates working with me to assist me, and I worked in the LNS Letters and Science pool of advisors. I wasn't particularly connected to history. And we would, at that point, work with students with what they were bringing to campus, the results of their test scores, so they would know where to start in math and in English and possibly in a foreign language. But they were not, in fact, enrolling for classes, because the assignment committees that I talked about happened just before the start of classes, fall or spring. So they would come up with a projected schedule of classes, which they might or might not get when they came back in the fall. But it was a chance to do orientation more broadly than just enrolling for classes. So we would be looking at what they were interested in, what they were bringing from high school, how the classes might fit together. I think we may have had the schedule to look at so that you could figure out that you weren't setting yourself up to do two things at the same time during the fall semester. And there were lots of advisors would come over from the math department. Advisors would be coming over staff from foreign language departments. and would sit and talk with students about their choices based on the results of their placement tests as they were choosing courses.
Okay. One more thing I just thought of. Since we were going to interview you at the Academic Staff Institute, I'd like to ask what you sort of knew or what you remember knowing about being an academic staff person during this first position in the history department.
Almost nothing. And this comes in as we begin to look at the transfer over into the School of Ed. What did work for me at SOAR in terms of academic staff was beginning to get to know staff who worked at SOAR who weren't necessarily linked to departments. But looking back, most of the staffing of SOAR was done by academic staff. Some faculty had summer assignments and worked it. So that looking at my career on campus in relationship to academic staff, some of my strong academic staff friendships began at SOAR. But I didn't know then to think of myself as academic staff. And I'd have to say, in addition to all the changes in enrollment practices that I witnessed and in which I participated, because I became active with SOAR, I think even before I got to the School of Ed, every summer, because I was so enthusiastic about it. Mm-hmm. And then over time, SOAR itself became an institutional entity full-time over the year, and I was very much a part of that. So my whole career after that first summer, which probably wasn't my first summer on campus, but when I got asked to do SOAR, from then on, I worked at SOAR until I retired. And academic staff became much, much clearer to me. And when I got into governance, that's all that's to come.
Right.
But thank you for the question, because at that time, I really had no understanding at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's shift now to the move from the history department to the School of Ed, and it looks like roughly 1986. So mm-hmm. The first question is, why change at that time?
Right, and this takes us right into the faculty academic staff. What I began to realize in the history department is that I was very isolated in terms of colleagues. The academic staff in the history department at that time, as I understood it at that time, the history department had and has a very significant project working with the federal government on the documents in relationship to the beginning of the United States, having to do with the First Congress, having to do with when it started, the ratification of the Constitution. And those people were academic staff people. But faculty are a species unto themselves. And I began to feel like I would like a larger scope for what I was doing. But most of all, I wanted colleagues who were not faculty. Because the universes are very different. For one, which I found striking in the history department, but I think it is campus-wide, pretty much faculty are so much driven by the research project. And the research project is often not here. So that there was a sense of the department belonged to the classified staff and me. And I got along pretty well with the classified staff. It was complicated. And when the opening for an assistant dean in the School of Ed came to my attention, I thought, I think this is what I would rather do. I think I'd rather be, I associated that job with what I knew of the Academic Affairs Office in Letters and Science, because I worked a fair amount with the people I understood to be deans in the College of Letters and Science. Now I know they were indeed assistant deans, and a lot of them were concurrently getting their PhDs. But I didn't know that at the time that I was working as an advisor. So I was looking to change the collegial setting in which I was working. and very much enjoyed the interview process, and was John Palmer was at that time dean of the School of Education, and I was their very clear second choice, and the first person they wanted turned him down. So there I was, across the hill and up the hill, in the old education building. And I've always been fascinated with how the terrain changes based on where your office is. So the university at which I worked when I was in the School of Education had almost nothing in common geographically with the university at which I worked when I was in the then Humanities Building, which regrettably is named after that remarkable man, George Mossy.
So is there a way you can explain a bit more what you mean by how the geography, it's not the geography per se.
It's the perspective.
Right, it's perspective.
Right.
As you change in geography.
Right.
So maybe a bit more on the perspective.
The history department, being in humanities, sits at the west end of State Street. So that the focus was very much State Street, the then Elvium. And what I'm talking about is the visual terrain. So to walk, every day to walk up Bascom to the education building, put the hill, and I'm not meaning the climbing up and down the hill so much as the, not only the visual, but humanities is a mixed blessing, we could say, the building. What's fun for me is, as a graduate student, it was being built. And one of my personal sort of records is that I have a son, and he was born in January of 67. And my aunt came out to visit at some particular point and took a picture of me. There was a wall around the hole, and the wall had marvelous graffiti, and I was a quite pregnant graduate student, and she placed me in front of the graffiti. I think what it said was teaching assistants or graduate teaching assistants are the heart of the strength of the university, words to that effect anyway, and there I am standing there, a TA, and I was a TA while I was pregnant, and my undergrads kept saying, "We didn't think you'd get to stay through the final. Are you really still here?" And for me, then, it was a come down for the history department to have been banished down to humanities from Bascom. I didn't think about it in complicated bureaucratic ways. I love, to this day, I adore Bascom Hall. And I love old education. And I loved looking at North Hall out my window. What I did was I moved my perceptions, literally, from sort of subway 20th century architecture to buildings where, John Muir was reputed to have had a dorm room in North Hall or whatever, and he was, his pictures in Bascom. And when I was, before I came to work at the university, I was married into part of the crowd who were doing the Institute for Environmental Studies, the people who were creating it. And there's, there was even that tension between who was creating it, enough of that. But, I learned to be very passionate about Aldo Leopold and everything that UW represents in that way. And my then husband was getting his PhD in history, but minoring in wildlife ecology or wildlife, working with McKay and those people. So it's a little bit far from the... And I've learned over time that the School of Ed came onto campus later than the College of Letters and Science. I'm interested in the history of post-secondary education. Not enormously, but I'm an historian, and it's just so interesting the way universities put themselves together. And I would often say to my students when they became frustrated with this or that about the university that it does not repay. Energy invested in trying to figure out how it all works is energy wasted, because it's people meeting in committees making decisions in a context that even at our, you know, even doing our best kind of history, we're not going to recreate the context. It's just not going to happen. Now, one of the things to throw in all here is that I started studying history when the human race was understood to be a single gender. And it's been really exciting intellectually for me to now live in a world where my partner's niece is choosing Beloit College to where she's going to go next year because it's so careful about encouraging non-specificity about gender. And I'm old enough so that I will say to my contemporaries, I think I understand why this is so important. But it's very difficult for me to kind of, it's not intuitive. Mm-hmm. I am as respectful as I know how to be of the truth of it. But listening to her last Thanksgiving, I was just fascinated to think, what do you know? When I came to school, what we would say is grad students in history. History was a history of tall white men. Mm-hmm. And then we learned to modify that tall, white, straight, temporarily able-bodied men. It's changed. Mm-hmm. And of course, it never was true.
Right.
So, and what I noticed in the students is that my history majors were much, much more diffuse in their interests and personalities than my teacher preparation students. The teacher preparation students, they knew where they were going, and that's what they were going to do. Now, blessedly, when I went over as assistant dean in the School of Ed, and then I morphed into being a senior advisor because things got reorganized over the time that I was there. But I worked with the art students, too. And I worked with, then we got occupational therapy and physical therapy. And physical therapy students are their own breed of cat completely. And, of course, these are generalizations, but... and then rehab psych. I mean, there was just... It wasn't entirely teacher preparation. And then fascinating to watch the faculty in the School of Ed with their varying understandings of the Department of Public Instruction and the extent to which the Department of Public Instruction could, you know, interfere on their turf, never mind that everything they were doing was so that our students could get licensed to teach. You know, so.
Thank you for all of that.
You're welcome.
There's probably various points I could cut in there to ask other questions. But I want to ask you a specific about this job in the School of Education, and that is, what was it? What did you do?
While I was assistant dean, I supervised the office which admitted and certified students, and I supervised a staff of 8, 10, 12, something like that, classified and academic staff. So I had advisors working for me, and I had classified staff working for me, and that was when classified staff still generated documents and did that kind of work. But they also really, really, really knew how to read a transcript to figure out if... I mean, one woman was assigned. She was the certification officer, and she knew what it took to be licensed to teach history, and she would read the transcript accordingly. And all of those people worked for me. And then I was... there was a field experiences office, which was parallel. And they supervised and were staffed by... classified staff and some graduate students who supervised the process by which the teacher preparation students were in the schools, and that was complicated. And when Palmer left, I think he was succeeded by Henry Chueba. I'm not positive. But Henry Chueba became the dean of the School of Ed. And he had a very, very... John Palmer himself had been a school teacher and was very much interested in schools and teaching. And Chueba became more fascinated with the arts end of things, but also was interested in redesigning things administratively. So the office which I supervised was tucked into the human relations office. They were put together. And the woman who was head of the human relations and field experience office, it was the field experience office, she became the assistant dean. And I was bumped to becoming senior student services coordinator, lost the administrative responsibility, but held on to SOAR and held on to working with students individually. So I think it would be fair to say that as an administrator, I was not enormously gifted, but I think we did fine. And I think we got a dean who had a different kind of taste for putting things together that maybe fit together, maybe they didn't. And I feel enormously fortunate to have been able to continue the work that I really love doing. And, you know, was it a status shift? Maybe. At that point, Henry Loeffler was assistant dean with some, now that I look back on it, some HR kinds of responsibilities, and he and I were friends. So I went into him and I said, so Hank, you know, they changed my position. Do you think I should make a fuss about it? He said, well, I sure hope you don't. But it was very good advice. I mean, one of the ways that I understand this institution is that you're far better served, and I'll... this comes up as I move into governance, never mind being an ombuds, but you're far better served not to fuss. And that's a large blanket statement, and I'm sure at the point at which Chueba put our offices together, the whole institution was smaller than it is now, and perhaps a little less bureaucratically dense. But again, I think it suited me better to be in the role that I was in. And for better or worse, the person who was put into what might have been my position was then asked to leave. I don't mean the day after tomorrow, but I'm pretty strong in my people skills, and she was dreadful with people skills. And by that time, Chuck Reed was the dean, and it mattered enormously to Chuck Reed that the people serving this woman were very, very unhappy. And that's one of the really high points, I would say, of my time here, was the conscientiousness with which he listened and looked and then asked her to work somewhere else, which she does, did. I don't know if she does anymore, but she did. Because he just wasn't going to have that going on in his staff.
So let me clarify then. So initially, when you came on board at the College of Ed, or School of Ed, excuse me, you still had student responsibilities. It sounded like to me
yes.
that there was a lot of administrating and not a lot of student interaction, but that wasn't the case.
That's true. And we were what would be called, I think, a fairly flat office, so that the assistant dean who preceded me was Chuck Quinn, and he had Bob Miller working for him, and Bob went on to become the secretary of the academic staff, not the first one, I don't think. Anyway, I don't have that in my head this minute. Maybe he was. Might have been. Anyway, and Chuck and Bob Miller saw students, and I saw students. But I didn't have... I mean, it's foggy in my mind. We went to a system in the unit, and I can't remember whether it was pre- or post-merger, where certain parts of the alphabet were assigned. But I certainly saw students the whole time. And when I worked at SOAR, I saw students, but I had more supervisory responsibilities when I was the assistant dean for staff. And I worked very, very, very hard at that. And I also in the role of assistant dean, got very, very caught up with quality improvement. And that's part of the space in which I got to understand academic staff sort of beyond the office. As some of the same people I'd run into at SOAR were very much involved with the quality improvement work. And there was a lot of back and forth as to whether or not there was any point in letting anybody leave her desk to go and learn how to do things more effectively. So, I mean, I would take time to go and do the training. And then I remember Hank Loeffler saying he didn't see what the point was because then I wasn't sitting at my desk. But that wasn't directed at me specifically. I think that's been, maybe not now, but at that point in the university's growth, there was a fair amount of skepticism about professional development, I think is what we would understand. And I think that's a lot of the way the academic staff over time has educated the campus. And now I'm really thinking more from inside governance, that university campuses cannot be run by faculty. It can't happen. Faculty do what they do, and I fervently believe in shared governance. But so much of the work, including academic research kinds of work, is done by academic staff, mm-hmm. and has to be. Going back to what I was saying about my realization in the history department, that the faculty weren't there. Sometimes they were. But even when they were, they might still be in Africa. You can't run UW-Madison when you're actually in Tanzania. Mm-hmm. Doesn't work.
So then, so is it at this point? So these early years at the School of Ed, I mean, you just alluded to it, if not just flat out said it, that you became more at least understanding of what academic staff did.
And what happened, very specifically, and this would have been after the merger, because I remember the office I was sitting in, so I wasn't the assistant dean anymore, and Char Tartarisi called and said, so, you want to be on MASA? She might even have said, do you want to be the head of MASA? Not positive, but, or if it wasn't her, it was Rick Deluge. But anyway, whoever it was called, and I thought, well, sure. I mean, who wouldn't? So, through them, and there had been activities that I went to that were sponsored by MASA. And what I understood through MASA was that academic staff was organizing in order to get ourselves voices in critical decisions affecting the university. So the assembly was coming into existence, and I don't have the dates on that. And the issues were common across campus. Having to do, I think quite naturally, I was more interested in getting departmental representation for instructional and research academic staff people, since the work of the institution is research and instruction. I don't think I've ever shifted from that, and I have a very, very passionate commitment to faculty as the core, and the faculty as a regenerating resource, so that, lots and lots of my conversations with undergraduates would have to do with going to grad school, and when I was in history, I used to tell them not to do it, and then one or two would come back when they were seniors and say, please. And then I thought, Linda, you're being way too heavy-handed. I came to telling people never take my advice unless you want to, but I give it very strongly. But at that point, I hadn't quite said that. But most people earning bachelor's degrees have had enough. And it equips you to do anything you want to do. And I still believe that. I think the whole STEM thing is a little misguided. But that's a different story. so that the enterprise of creating and disseminating knowledge was never done alone by the faculty. And partly because from MASA I went on to ASIC, went on to be chair of ASIC, and that group of people with whom I served on ASIC were very, very interested in the professorial titles for academic staff. And it was a fit for me, because while I was and remain skeptical about how much the world does or doesn't understand distinctions among titles, depending on, you know, how much towards the center or on the periphery you are, for a person to earn a PhD wherever he or she did and come and do that kind of work here but not be tenure track should have no less investment in the institution. If we were parsing it, they should have more. But, I mean, either side of that's absurd. And the people that the faculty train are not all going to be tenure track faculty, if you just look at the numbers. But Research One universities, or Research Two, because I don't know what the difference would be, must have staff beyond the tenure track faculty. And we do. So then it's a question of, are we equals? Well, that's a vexed question. But do we have institutional support for governance? And the answer very clearly is yes. And we have it in the Assembly, and we have it in the Faculty Senate, and we have it in the Associate Students of Madison. And one of the things that characterizes citizens at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I would assume most post-secondary institutions, is everybody can talk. Now, I exaggerate. And my respect for people who do technology is infinite, and their patience with those who don't have happy relationships with the technology, their patience is incredible. The number of people who've sat very quietly while I've just... And then when I calm down, we can resolve the problem. So they don't talk so much. And it's so much fun to articulate what's important in terms of the well-being of the people doing the enterprise, doing the work here, and in terms of their sense of their own worth. I mean, that's really where my passion is for, and I would talk to people about, you know, dividing the whole university into A's and B's, and on day one, the A's would tell the B's they were doing great work, and the next day, the B's would say the same to the A. And it makes a difference. So maybe you want to ask me something.
So we're talking about academic staff, about your sort of learning about academic staff. So did you choose to become president of MASA when either Shar or Rick asked you to?
Yeah.
And that was after 91, when you became senior service. So 91 is when you've been calling it the merger.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, it was.
Okay.
And that probably meant that I had more freedom to be out of the office than I would have been if we hadn't merged. I'd never thought of that before.
Do you recall, I think you alluded to it, if not flat out said it, but as you became head of MASA, what were your interests in leading it, and did they dovetail with what MASA's general interests were in academic staff issues?
Yes. As I remember, we were very interested in having governance structures. So I don't remember where we were in the process of the Assembly, but I think the Assembly was already in place, because I went from MASA to ASEC, and there wouldn't have been any ASEC except when there was an assembly. And where I was, I mean, I worked a lot on the professorial titles that to some degree belonged to Wilt Sanders and the guy in Ag, who was just at a, he was part of, this guy whose name I'm not remembering, was part of a panel that Joe Elder was on at the Institute, but I'm not remembering.
So Stephen Hagen?
Yeah, Bill. Bill was also very, very interested in the professorial titles, and I was very supportive because I felt as if I understood it well, having started in the departments. And that's one of my biases, is that I feel as if you don't understand the university as well if you weren't grounded in a department. Probably fair to say you understand it differently. And I remember being at the College of Engineering at a CASI meeting. I was very, very excited with the development of the CASIs. And they seemed to me to represent one of the really fundamental accomplishments of academic staff governance. But one of my colleagues, whom I knew well from SOAR, we were talking about professorial titles, and he was saying in the kind of, I don't mean this to sound disrespectful, it may be a little bit extra benevolent tone, that I should have, Linda Newman should, of course, have a professorial title. Well, that was perfectly ridiculous. Of course I shouldn't have a professorial title. I did not finish my dissertation. I've never been involved in research. So part of what I get interested in is it's a complex system here. All of them are, I'm sure, but this is the one I've lived in for years and years and years. And no, it's not accurate to say that an administrative academic staff person should have a professorial title. No, she shouldn't. And it isn't either true that all research and all instructional. But I think the place that you could put the two together would be with the indefinite appointments. I mean, the indefinite appointment is said to be analogous to tenure, and I think it is. But it's analogous not because of the length of the appointment, but because of the qualifications in order to get that affirmation. It's never been a job security issue. People talk about it that way. It annoys me. It has to do with recognizing the accomplishments in the framework of what it takes to do research and teaching, and not necessarily both, because we have tenured faculty who don't do much teaching. Because of the nature of their research. Fine. I mean, those are reasonable decisions. And I was very ferocious, and I think contextually with my colleagues, with instructional academic staff, never mind the titles, being involved in curricular decisions within the departments. It was perfectly ridiculous for them not to. And not graduate students. I mean, graduate students are apprentices. Academic staff may have been graduate students. And I also get very worked up about terminal degrees. I think that's what you need in order to qualify for these kinds of titles. There's other kinds of titles. And what I got teased for somewhat by Barry Robinson and Wilt Sanders and was I was always talking about communication, always. And no matter how often we said communication was critical, I said it again. And I am very fiercely opposed to the notion that if you put it on the web, you have communicated. No, you haven't. Many people, myself included, don't necessarily like to read stuff on the web. Stuff on the web ages out, and you don't necessarily have staff or inclination to correct it. And when you want participation, it makes no sense to set up barriers. So if somebody calls and says, I need this piece of information, you want to do something with that verbally, send them something through, you know, all the ways we can send things, and refer them to the web, of course. But what I would run into at times in governance was somebody who said, we don't need to go across campus and talk to people. I also was doing facilitating surveys and would have people come and talk about how they would like to see the campus change, but I didn't have the kind of support from the Secretary of the Academic Staff at that point to translate all that into documents that we could send out. So we kind of lost it. Well, we've had very different Secretaries of the Academic Staff since then. And the one I worked with was Colleen McCabe, and I liked her enormously. But she had a very, this is what we do, and we don't necessarily expand. And I'm very expansive. The follow-through, maybe not so much. But particularly people talking to to each other. And we had meetings to look at how things might be done better. But we didn't know what to do with the data that we collected. So,
One or two more things this time. So you've talked about SOAR a lot, and I want to make sure we, at least in this session, you get to say what you did if it were indeed different at SOAR when you were at School of Ed as opposed to SOAR when you worked for the History Department.
Okay. The SOAR itself became, through Donna Shalala's efforts, a two-day experience, much more campus-wide in its staffing. And we got registration at SOAR. In the School of Ed, when I worked at SOAR, and I kept it independent of my title, I hired the advisors to work at SOAR. I led that team, so to speak. And we hired students, and that was some of my most intense work with students. The people that I hired to work with me at SOAR, I would work SOAR, but some of my fellow advisors would work at SOAR also for the School of Ed. And I'm trying to think who had the leadership of it. I think it would have been Letters and Science initially. We developed a SOAR team. I think it would have been Dick Barrows from Agriculture for a while was sort of heading that up, where we met all year round in order to think about how most effectively to get the information that a student needed to SOAR those 2 days that he or she was at SOAR. And we worked very hard to maximize the academic benefits to the incoming freshmen. And over the years, our concern with and care for the parents increased across time, because parents, I think, became more engaged in our awareness that we couldn't just, you know, wish we could stick them in a closet and lock the door. That was not a healthy response to their desire to be engaged with what the student was enrolling in. And I did a lot of work with welcoming the whole group on the first day of SOAR. I did a lot of communication work at SOAR and supervised everybody who does SOAR at the School of Ed. And to this day, that's a place where I can get a little, because I'm in touch with the School of Ed staff and the evolution of the SOAR program, and you know, now that I'm retired and not able to make it all happen, they're doing fine. But that communication piece is so incredibly important. And for students, but I feel the same way about staff, we need to assure each other that we're doing fine and that our sense of how things might be better needs to be nourished. In terms of a student, he or she needs to be encouraged to take the courses that are going to be the most interesting, to step away if things aren't working with the notion that they'll come back. But it's sort of like I want to bring more air into the conversation. I want to bring spaciousness. I want to bring a pause. Because if you don't draw back, and you've done all these things in high school, and you've taken all these AP credits, and your mom and your grandpa think you're going to do this, it's very hard to figure out how to make the space to say, I really might like to be a computer engineer. I know they want me to come back to the farm. Whatever it is. And I don't have the words for it this minute, but there's an analog in terms of how we support ourselves as staff, too. And we the campus is, now this is very much flowing over into Ombuds, but the campus is horrendous in its negligence around what it takes to supervise. Just horrendous. And the pain, I mean, because all we've had are budget cuts. So we need to learn how to be creative around that and careful, which has nothing to do with the outcome. You know, your kids are at such a great age for what's happening right here and how might we change that just a little, which says nothing about what's going to happen in high school. Nothing. But we have that kind of freedom here, too. And if we don't have any money, how about if we talk to each other a little more? Not about money. But you didn't ask that question.
Well, but I might. So I think I want to wrap up today with sort of looking at this chronologically, and I know some of your discussions have moved into the present day.
Right.
But let's look at this as, you know, your time at the history department and then your early time at the ed department.
Right.
And maybe before giving you space for final comments, maybe what sort of memorable experiences stand out from those years?
Wow.
Big question, I know.
Oh, it's a wonderful question. The key experiences of those years were student-faculty connections. And I worked across the hall from George Mossy. And some of the highlights are undergraduates of mine whom he worked with and who really caught on with him. But also relationships with faculty. I mean, I think my devotion to faculty comes from both places because the stature, the magnanimity, the attention to detail among the faculty with whom I worked was just extraordinary. And what I developed, and I think it was in those times, particularly after I started at the School of Ed early on, was realizing that if a faculty person had a student here, a child, it was the most lovely way to talk to them, to listen to the person. And I loved working in the history department with the faculty in terms of what courses they were going to offer. And the undergraduate seminars were what I loved because they got to teach something small and maybe related to their research, maybe not. But it was going to be a different kind of relationship between that faculty person and the students in the seminar. But most of all, what I wanted was for the students to find that professor who was just going to change everything for them. And they do, really, really often. And sort of on the other side of that, and more in the era of email, to try to get through to students that you don't send an email to a faculty person to say, please let me into your course because I like the time it meets. And some of the wonderful conversations would come when a student was really thinking about independent study. Again, not because I need three more credits, but had kind of done everything he could think of to do in a subject area. And then we would talk about how you might go and talk to a professor whom you've had a course with to see if you could do an independent study to follow up on what you're beginning to be really excited about. And I also loved getting through to students that they could change the trajectory I would say to them, advisors really have a lot of magic around the calendar. So if you're coming up on a deadline to drop and you really need some data you're not going to get till after the deadline, we can work with that. I'll put it in the notes that we said, if the grade comes back in Chem 103, where you're just not going to do well enough and it's going to absorb so much of the time between now and your finals that you really want to drop it, we can drop it after the deadline. But that's because you came now and we're having the conversation and you're recognizing that you may or may not be able to master the material. And I would also encourage my students early on in the semester to drop if things weren't working. And that was very hard for them to kind of get that really would just vanish and then they'd have more time. But they also often felt, and their parents felt, that doing more each semester would get you to the end point quicker. So I would talk to them about having to go to the hospital because they were so exhausted and not finish the semester at all. Mm-hmm. So think about that.
Mm-hmm. Any final thoughts today, just in general? Anything that, and this is
yes.
broad again, but it doesn't time specific. Anything you feel like you want to get on the record now in case we don't
yes.
meet again?
As a friend reminded me recently, I am a trained historian. And what I truly love and have loved from the time, as far as I knew all there was humanities building and the historical society. Is the university's respect for its own history. And not so much when he was doing archives, but Frank Cook became a very good friend of mine. And studying history and working with the historians here has been a privilege like nothing else. Obviously not uniformly. And Maury Meisner, who taught Chinese history here, when he would turn in his slips for his course, because it was all done on paper, the line across the top would be the dean has once again refused my suggestion that we just don't have next semester, in light of which fact this is what I'm going to teach next semester.
Well, Linda, I want to thank you very much for agreeing to come here and meet and talk with me today. I appreciate it. So this concludes the interview with Linda Newman.